when you have realistic expectations about a situation, 99% that situation works out just fine. It's when you have unrealistic expectations. You know, so for me, it was like I had the realistic expectation of I'm going to come here and it is going to be saturated. It's going to be impossible to get a gig for 3 months. I need to have enough money to survive for 3 months without working. Or I have to take another job to be able to do this. And you know, once you set those real expectations, sometimes that's not how it is in a good way.
I cannot change the way the world is. Only to me can I be true. No matter how much I affirm this, won't be the same without you.
All right. Welcome, everybody, to Nashville Drummers Podcast, episode 20. My favorite number.
Wow, I can't believe, does it feel like 20? Is that like a milestone, you think?
I think it is. I really should have brought that bourbon.
Yeah, we were talking about that earlier. Yeah. I want to say quickly, thanks again for all of our listeners so far and all the support in the community. If you're new here, please give us a follow on Instagram at Nashville Drummers Podcast and check out our website, nashvilledrummerspodcast.com. Sign up for our email newsletter and definitely leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. That really helps the podcast grow and helps us reach new listeners. So we appreciate your support.
Our next guest is a Nashville-based multi-instrumentalist and educator, having performed, recorded, and written as a drummer, vocalist, pianist, and guitarist.
Damn, that's very talented.
That's a lot of stuff.
It's a lot of things. We're mostly just talking to drummers on here. Mm-hmm. But this guy is, yeah, we're going to get into
all that. Really raising the bar.
He is known mostly for his work as a drummer and percussionist for artists including Ben Schuller, Endless Earth, Too Hot for Leather, Ryan Clark, Palmer Anthony, and Ali Keck.
Received his Bachelor of Music Education at Central Michigan University and his Master of Percussion Performance at Michigan State University.
And upon moving to Nashville here in 2021, he immediately began working as a regular on Lower Broadway, where many of you may know him with his regular act, Too Hot for Leather. And with that, please help us welcome Kevin Keith to the podcast. What's up, Kevin?
How you doing, guys?
Good.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Yeah. Anytime.
Yeah, man. So moved in 2021. Where are you from?
I'm from Michigan originally.
Michigan, that's right.
So center of the state, small town. Lived there through my college years until I got my master's degree at Michigan State. And then I moved to Denver for 5 years. So I lived out in the mountains for 5 years and then moved here in 2021. So yeah, just three different places. Didn't move around a ton as a kid. I was in one place for a long, long time. Very, very yeah. Kind of nice, quiet, small town in Michigan. And yeah, so that's where I've been.
How was moving in pandemic year 2021, right?
You know, it was kind of right as things started to reopen. I remember the day before I left Denver was the first day I ate at a restaurant with full capacity.
Oh.
Since like March. And it was the first day they started really reopening things up. And it was right as I was leaving town.
That feel kind of, I don't know, cathartic to leave on a positive note.
That's a great way to look at it. Yeah. And I actually went back a couple of times over that summer to play a couple gigs that I still had left over from a band that I was working with out there, a party wedding cover band. So it was kind of cool to go back and do things again. You know, so I still had the chance to go back. But yeah, it was a little weird in that way. As a cathartic is a good word. I would venture weird almost more than anything else. It's almost like it felt like this very close the door kind of moment.
Yeah.
You know, like it was a great time. It's time to go, but it's good to see that, you know, this place will still be here.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. It's one thing to leave when things are like, well, don't know what's going to happen now.
Right. Yeah.
Like, hope you guys hold on for dear life. You're like, no, yep. things are kind of going back to normal.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
I don't feel like there's no sense of guilt.
No. And it wasn't. Yeah, definitely. I don't remember feeling guilty at all. It was definitely a feeling of, okay, you've done what you needed to do. It's time to go and experience this new thing.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's awesome.
Sure, yeah. And I'm sure all the details of which I'm sure we'll cover at some point.
Yeah.
Know, but it's, yeah, it was. That's, I hadn't really thought about it that way until you brought that up. So that's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, man.
My mind is already opening. Thanks to Nathan's life.
Hey, look, this is awesome. I am the opener of minds.
The opener of minds.
Yes. All right, everyone, breathe with me.
Wim Hof.
Breathe in, breathe out. Feel.
We need to do a breathing session.
We do.
With
you know
Drew.
What?
You, me, Drew, and then.
Yeah, I heard
that.
We'll live stream it. It'll be great.
Oh, my. And I'll just do a shameless Wim Hof impression. Vim.
Wim Hof impression the entire time. I'll just do the whole thing like by script. And we got to get someone to play the guitar and that whatever that little synth sound that plays at the end.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about? I think so.
Like every time it gets to that, I'm like, oh, it's okay to be alive. Existence is good.
Yeah, yes. I start crying.
Yeah,
it'll be sponsored by Aquafina and Forks. It'd be great.
Yeah,
there you go. So that's who the new sponsor is. Water.
Nice.
Yeah, not Forks, but
brought to you. You know what?
We do drink a lot of water.
We do. Okay, let's start.
Okay.
Let's start with the beginning of your musical journey. What does that look like for you?
My parents put me in piano lessons when I was 4. And their story is they had an upright piano at their house that was
awesome.
My mom's is from her house when she was a kid. It was an old spinet piano. And she said that they always tell the story that I was starting to pick things up by ear. Mm-hmm. On the piano, like playing, we used to go to church all the time, you know, I was young and I was playing these, you know, hymn tunes from church. I was playing on piano, but from ear, getting them wrong, of course, in many ways, but getting them close enough where they'd recognize them. And the one person at the church was a piano teacher, this short Welsh woman would just drive you into the ground if she could. I mean, she's just very driven, very motivated, you know, motivated her students super well. And she just passed away, actually, God rest her soul. And Meyer Alsgaard was her name. Yeah. And she was wonderful. And she talked to my parents at the church one day and said, if he's starting to play by ear, you need to get him in lessons right now.
Yeah, that's a good sign.
So he can learn, but not even so much like, you know, he's going to be great. It's like, no, I mean, I don't think anyone really knows, but.
Yeah, it's funny, just to say quickly, as you're telling this story, I'm hearing her, despite the fact that I have no idea what she sounds like. I know the accent so well because my first teacher was also Welsh.
No way.
So I'm hearing that going.
Is that why you asked me what her name was, just in case?
Wanted to hear it in that voice, like how I imagined. Anyway.
And Meyer Alsgaard, she married into the Alsgaard family. Alsgaard obviously not being a Welsh name at all. But she said that mainly because she didn't want me to get to a point where I couldn't read music. And I only worked by ear. You know, as you said, you don't want him to get to that point. You know, if he's going to be playing music in school and public school, they all read music and you want to be able to do that. And so there's another musician working at the church, pianist, Bill Bankstall. And he was my first music teacher. I mean, he was great with kids. Like he was one of those people, just super flamboyant. They're very outgoing.
Yeah.
He teaches people how to love the instrument.
Yeah. You know, charisma, more, man.
Very
yeah.
much so, you know, and he was very, you know, he got to a certain point. He's like, okay, he's progressing to a certain level. Go to Meyer now.
At an early age. I had the same experience with percussion lessons. Like those early teachers, like, they were actually very talented. It was actually like through the orchestra back home. But it was the same idea. Like they taught me how to really love the instrument. And then at a certain point, it was like, okay, you've advanced beyond what I feel capable to provide you.
Right.
And now it's like level up to the next guy.
That's so important, you know? And it's something that, you know, it's something I've tried to maintain just in anything, you know, where if I hit a level of anything and I'm not providing, there's somebody else that will do it better. And if it's, especially if it's a student, you know, it's okay, go work with this person, you know, because I'm still learning, you know? But yeah, and I started studying with her when I was in third or fourth grade. I stayed through piano lessons all through high school, but I started taking drum lessons in sixth grade with the start of public school band with middle school band. And I would have to say that was probably, if I can point to any particular property that my parents have that I'm like super thankful that they have, it's that they made me wait for things when I was a kid. And I hated it when I was a kid, you know, it was awful. And I look back on that and I'm like, thank the Lord they did, you know, cause I wouldn't have been ready. You know, I wouldn't have been ready for drum lessons when I was in elementary school.
Yeah.
I had so much to learn. I had so much discipline to learn. You know, I feel like I was a really scattered kid at times.
Yeah. You know, so when you say like, you they know, made you wait, will you kind of jump in to take lessons, drum lessons?
I wanted a drum set since I was in like first grade or second grade. I mean, and they had a pair of drumsticks in the car so I could play drums along to records in the car.
So they were like teasing you.
No, I wouldn't say I would say teasing me. They were more excited. I mean, like just making sure that I had something to do while they were waiting to get to that point, you know, but there was this little bag that they had that would attach to the headrests of the car and it would just hang down on the back seat and it had, you know, toys or, you know, supplies and stuff like that. And I would just beat the piss out of it, you know, with my drumsticks. And I would, to like Beatles, right? I listened to Beatles and Queen. The first two albums they ever played me were Past Masters Volume 2 by the Beatles So like the later stuff, yeah. not the early Beatles, but the later Beatles, and then Queen Greatest Hits, Volume One.
Wow.
And so it was like
from, as a child,
they
pretty good selection.
Talk about developing your ear right
yeah.
away.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't say it enough, and if, I'm sure my parents are listening to this, but yeah, you're so cool. You guys are the coolest parents.
They love you.
They really did, you know. But
dude, it is so, yeah. that is I'm not realizing to it be more. Understated how yeah. incredibly valuable it is to have parents who value music. I'm just going to say mm-hmm. it straight up. Who value music yeah. as a teaching tool, as just something that adds to your life, whether your kid's going to be a musician or not.
Right. Yeah.
It's I don't understand when it's not a part of the thing. Like, bring it into your kids' lives because it will just add value. Absolutely. Bottom line, I don't care if they're going to play.
Yeah, no, and that's 100% true. You know, and that was, I had to adapt that. For a long time, of course, I was thinking, you know, when I started off teaching, you know, and getting into that realm, and I was young and, you know, silly and stupid, you know, yeah. but it was like teaching for music's sake. And the idea that these kids, I'm going to make these kids be musicians. They're going to be musicians when they grow up. And it's like, that is so not the point.
Yeah.
You know, like it's totally okay if you got a student who is top of their class and their high school band and they're scoring top in their class and their solo ensemble events and their INEs and all that stuff, going out and do drum corps or whatever, yep. you know, and they don't go into music for the rest of their life.
Yeah.
It's I think that's almost better in yeah. some ways.
Because that kid is still enriched. Like they're still learning so much valuable.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, content from that they're never going to lose.
And they're going to take that into their careers, whatever they do. They're going to take that love of hopefully learning into their careers, you know? And it's like, that's, I think what it is. You just have to teach them how to love, how to learn more yeah. than anything else,
right.
you know? And that's thankfully having parents like I did, they are learners. You know, they're always looking for stuff. They love to learn stuff. You know, my dad, he called himself, you know, a warehouse of useless information, because he'll just know things about things that no one has any business knowing things
right.
about.
Yep.
But he just likes to learn stuff. And it's like, that's such a wonderful way to live life.
Right.
You know, like they do. And so it's like, you know, if I can get even close to them, you know, with that yeah. stuff. So that was, you know, short story long, that's where my music career began.
Yeah.
It was like that long ago, but with that context, I guess.
Yeah. So do you remember the first drum lesson? So you went from the sticks in the car to then your parents decided, okay, he's ready. Yeah. I'm just curious if you have a story or a memory of that.
I don't know if I remember my first lesson, actually.
Yeah. But it was probably through the public school, right?
It was with a private teacher, actually.
Private teacher, okay.
Yeah. The public school system I was in Midland at the time was small enough that we didn't have like private instructors at the school. We actually had one. I'd imagine there's more, but the one guy in town who had been teaching in that town for 30 years up until that point, since 1977. I'd started in 2000, I guess it would have been 2001, yep. 2-ish around there. But he was the guy, you know, Jim Volkerson. He was born and raised in Midland, Michigan, went to Midland High School where I went to high school, gigged for a long time, and then, you know, got married, had a family, and started this teaching studio. He teaches 6 days a week, I want to say, 5 or 6 days a week, and he teaches from 2 p.m. to 10 p.m. every single day. Every single slot is filled. Like, yeah.
wow.
All times a year. You know, it's like there are wait lists at times to get it. I think there's a spot that opens up and stuff. It's like for this small little community.
Yeah, he's got the market cornered.
Yeah, yeah. And for good reason, too.
Yeah.
You know, really for good reason. He runs a percussion ensemble program, and he has levels of percussion ensemble. So he has a third and fourth grade ensemble, fifth and sixth grade, seventh and eighth grade, low high school, high school, and then like a beginner adult group. So if there are people that always wanted to play percussion, never got to as a kid, and then he has them come in and do percussion ensemble, like teaches them as they're going through the ensemble and stuff. But that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
You know, so that was the drum teacher, but it's, no, I don't remember my first lesson, actually. I'm trying to rack my brain. I remember there are other definitely like, I would say checkpoints yeah. that I do remember, but not my first one.
Yeah.
Which is weird. I think it would. But
do you remember the moment that the switch kind of flipped and you're like, oh yeah, drums,
yeah.
really drums.
Yeah. I think it was when he started handing me Neil Peart charts.
Oh, yep.
And as I'm sure a lot of drummers would agree, you know, I think that's the bench point for a lot of, and he had the photocopies of the old like mid 2000s book. Someone went through and transcribed all the hits, and he went, you know, Red Barchetta, Subdivisions, Jacob's Ladder. He was throwing all this wow. stuff. And that's how I learned about odd time signatures, you know, yeah. and playing out of just straight, you know, four on the floor stuff. And I think that was more when it became not so much just like I want to be really good at this, to a, man, this is something I want to do the rest of my life. You know, and that's that, so cool. Yeah. It was when he started having me just play along and just said, learn how to read these, you know, and it just kind of just out of the blue.
Yeah.
You know, got lucky in that way. But yeah.
It sounds like your parents' influence is really impactful for you, and like their love of learning was kind of also passed on to you.
Yeah.
Would you say like you also kind of fell into that compassion for education and learning, and then you think that kind of propelled you forward to what you would eventually study in college, and you know, and you're actively teaching now, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've taken a bit of a break from the public school education. Okay. I still do lessons here and there, private lessons from time to time.
Yeah.
But for about 10 years or so, I was working as a percussion instructor in the public schools, whether it was in Michigan or Colorado, and then for a year here. And especially when it clicked that teaching the kids music isn't about teaching them music, it's about teaching them life lessons.
Mm-hmm. You know, all the other things. Right?
It's really about, you know, and I think more than anything, you know, I won't get too deep into, you know, the societal stuff, right? But like at a time like this, the last thing we need is like to pump out drones and clones.
Yeah.
Just kids telling us they're doing what we tell them to do. You know, it's, we need kids thinking for themselves and empowered to see the world around them in a positive way,
mm-hmm.
in a way that will then influence the rest of the world positively. Mm-hmm. And I think personal opinion is the best way to do that is to teach them really how to learn on their own.
Right.
You know,
100%.
To find the information, do research, you know, challenge your opinion at all costs, you know, mm-hmm. always challenge your opinion and then come out the end. Then you're coming out the end, the best possible person, best yeah. possible musician, whatever, you know, profession you end up in or whatever your goal yeah. is. But that was something my parents always instilled, was just, you know, the goal is to be as good a person, I think, at the end of the day.
Well, and you know, simply trying to tyrannize kids into doing the music thing,
yeah.
the technical best, it just simply won't work.
No, absolutely not.
Because
no.
especially with kids, you're like, okay, your job, if you're doing music education or real, probably any kind of education for a child, is keeping them interested in it.
Yeah.
Like I made the mistake when I was first teaching so much that I'd be like, all right, so working on whatever it is, I'm like, the technique's not quite right. So let's really focus on that until we get it right. It becomes this dry technical exercise. And they lose focus on the fact that we're learning a song that you like.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get bored and they don't want to play drums anymore. I'm like,
yeah, at that point, you've lost them.
I can fix a bad habit, but I can't fix you not loving the instrument anymore.
Yeah.
Like, and I'll say this, I've said this to a bunch of my students. I don't just want you to be a good drummer. I want you to have a good life.
Absolutely.
And I'm like, giving you this stuff is going to like somehow enrich your life, awesome.
Yep.
If the path to you becoming a great drummer, which you like talk to me, oh, this is what I want to be great. And like, if that's going to make you like miserable or hate your life, suicidal, like what is the point of me teaching you at all?
No, it you hit a point when it becomes, you know, and I think you put it well with the idea of, you know, tyrannizing kids into learning, right?
Yeah.
You know, tyrannizing. What I hear the most from people, educators, parents, is their concern that if you tyrannize them, they'll stop caring and they'll stop doing what you ask them to do. And I found there's a little bit of an opposite other side of the coin where you tyrannize them into learning, they do everything you want. They
right.
want you to do, and they do it with zero joy.
Right, yeah. Which is worse.
Is the yeah, it was worst
worse. Thing it's way worse.
Ever. They're doing what you ask them to do, and you can see the dread in their eyes.
Yeah.
And that is the worst feeling in the world. And I've seen it too many times, you know, from myself and others. You know, obviously, I've made that mistake numerous times.
Yeah.
And I've learned never to do that again, you know, or at all costs, and that, you know, direct away from that. But, when COVID did hit, I mean, and I was working as the percussion, the main percussion instructor for the middle and high school that I was teaching at, you know, I almost stopped caring. I mean, I had to face it myself where it was, what's the point in a way? You know, I think we all kind of had this crisis moment of what does this all mean if the world's ending? You know, what does it really mean? You know,
right.
And I think that was maybe when it really shifted in terms of how do I have to teach and what, because I couldn't teach the kids mallet instruments because most of them didn't have mallet instruments at home, and there's no point teaching them if they can't execute it and work on it on their own. And you know, I looked at every single one of my students over Zoom, over the camera, and you know, I remember distinctly my one student. She was in eighth grade at the time, and she was one of those kids just only wanted to play mallets, and I said, didn't want to touch a drum. And I looked at her and I said, here's the deal, you can't play mallets right now. Yeah. It's not possible. You don't have a mallet instrument at home. I know you have a piano. Yeah. We can do a little bit of working on that, the theory, but you can't play mallets, you know, and I can have you play on FA, you know, but I think our time would be better used if we made you the best snare drummer you can ever be. And I said, what do you think about that? And bless her heart, she looked me in the eye and said,
talk about a tough conversation to have with
a
child.
And I was like, I'm either going to lose this poor student. And I'm like, I'm trying to do everything I can. And like, I know this is not what she wants, but it's like, we got, you know, just do what you can. Yeah. And bless her heart, she looked me dead in the eye and she said, okay. Yeah. And I was like, okay, great. You know, and that's when I realized the kids are far more resilient than any of us.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
You know, and you know, thank goodness they are, because they just rode with it. And it was, again, they did whatever you asked them to do. And it was that delicate, I hope I'm not telling them to do something wrong here.
Yeah.
Because they are doing exactly what I ask them to do. And, they're in the worst possible position with this whole thing.
Oh, it's crazy. You feel so bad for all these kids that had to miss graduations, and miss senior years.
Yep.
But it's like, they're going to grow up and be so much more prepared for the world, you know?
And I hope they are. I really do, you know? But just seeing that, it's like, I was hopeful for the future.
Yeah.
That we're gonna be okay. You know, it might take until this generation gets into places where they can influence things.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, those are the ones who will be, you know, helping us out, you know, and I'm very proud of them. But yeah.
Man, so speaking of all, you know, music education and teachers, I'm really curious to hear more about your time at Michigan and, you know, getting your master's of percussion. I mean, that's no joke.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, master's of percussion performance, right?
Yeah. Percussion performance. Yeah.
Because we talked to a lot of different people on here. I would say majority of them, you know, probably are more drum set and don't have that classical background. We just talked to John Butterworth, actually, who did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I do as well. Awesome. But I think we're kind of the rarity.
Of course,
I think it's always so interesting to hear. Kaylee Moyer, you know, also in that same vein.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm definitely interested to hear more about how that's kind of influenced, you know, where you are now.
Yeah. I studied pretty exclusively classical percussion in school. So I was doing marimba literature, you know, auditioning. I was auditioning for orchestras for about 3 years. I was on the audition circuit.
So at that point, is your mindset like, I'm going to be in an orchestra and that's it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was the track.
It was, you know, and it was obvious. Yeah. I love playing chamber music as well. Being at Michigan State and Central Michigan really instilled.
Yeah, they have a great studio.
They do.
And do you remember some of those pieces?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Trying to think. You did like Xenakis.
We did. We did the Pleiades. What was that? The last movement of Pleiades. The Poe.
Yeah, I never did that. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and we all had to play to a click track, and and it was wild. I mean, it was, you know, all these things you'd think would be exclusive to, you know, modern drum set performance, and we were playing to click tracks and you know, all this stuff. I played Poe. When we were at Central. This is Graham, like, nerding out about all this classical stuff. I haven't been out in a while about it. We're at Central. It was almost, not exclusively, but very close to exclusively a percussion orchestra school. So we were playing all the, like, 70s, 80s, 90s percussion ensemble literature from when a guy named Robert Honer was the professor. He was one of the champions of, like, percussion orchestra. So there was, like, 11 or 12 of us in an ensemble at any given time. Robert Honer,
is that... H-O-E or H-E-O, rather?
No, it's H-O-H-N-E-R.
Okay. I was wondering if it was any relation to the music company.
It's not. It's a different name. Yeah. Right. Yep. He was the professor of Central Michigan for a while until he passed away, and then my professor took over. He's retiring this year. So it's
who's
like,
that?
Andrew Spencer is his name.
Okay.
Dr. Spencer. Yeah, and he's retiring, and deservedly so. He's amazing.
Yeah.
Incredible educator. Talk about people who teach you how to love just learning things.
Yeah.
He's another one.
Shout out to John Kinsey, right?
Shout out to John Kinsey, yes.
You met him at your time in Colorado?
I met him. I went to the festival that he worked at, Colorado College Summer Music Festival. And that was one of those summer institutes where you go for 3 weeks, you play in a festival orchestra with a bunch of other people that applied, auditioned, and won positions in the orchestra. And the time there was fully funded by private donors. So you had sponsors for the festival. So I didn't have to pay for room and board, my tuition there. Everything was covered by a sponsor.
Yep.
It's a wonderful program. I mean, it's an amazing opportunity for folks, especially someone like me that didn't grow up playing orchestral music. I grew up playing drum set. You know, I was a drum set kid. Mm-hmm. And then I went to college and had to kind of learn. But yeah, I met John through that, and he convinced me to move to Denver and give it a shot, you know, and just be out there. And it was really cool. He was a great mentor. And, friend. And
so I was at PASIC last year, just to fill you in, and so I think he's still the Colorado Symphony, right?
Principal percussionist.
So because you know, all those guys are there, and he's a Pearl endorser, so
he is.
I'd met him for the first time. Somehow, I think probably just because he was like, oh, like, you live in Nashville. And he brought up Kevin's name immediately. And just like, oh my God,
that's
you know awesome. Kevin.
He's
like,
awesome.
He had nothing but great things to say about you.
Oh my, he's such a kind man.
Will you be back at PASIC this year? I guess John will probably be back, but
he might be. This just depends on his orchestra, performing schedule with the orchestra. Right. If they have a big concert planned, you know,
but you don't go anymore, right?
I mean,
on your own.
I didn't go. I went twice when I was in Colorado. Once was sponsored by University of Denver. I did a little extra schooling while I was out there. Mm-hmm. And then the second time was on my own. But I didn't go. That was the last year before COVID hit. So I haven't been there since.
Yeah.
But I did go 2018-19. I went back when I was at Central. We'd go every year and we had like a school funded bus and stuff like that. We'd pay for our hotel rooms. We'd get vans paid for by the school.
That's how a lot of the kids end up going through the studio.
Absolutely. Yeah. But yeah, so I went there right before COVID, but I haven't been back since yet.
Yeah, I can't wait. I'm going back this year.
Mm. And it was
I was there last year, but this is going to be like kind of the revival of it.
Yeah, definitely.
So I'm excited.
Back to being full PASIC mode.
Yeah, 100%.
It's so much fun. Yeah.
So yeah, man, I guess continuing in your story there, like, at that point, so you're like fully on with the orchestral thing.
Absolutely.
You did, so you were 2 years at Central, then you went to Michigan for your master's?
I did.
Was it 4 years?
5 years.
Five years.
It was a music education track.
Okay.
And so I had to do an extra semester of classwork and then student teaching.
Yeah.
So I was auditioning for my master's programs while I was student teaching and all that. And then 2 years at Michigan State for the master's degree. And then I spent 3 years in Denver kind of doing like post-grad work, just essentially taking lessons from John. At his school out there is a Lamont School of Music at the University of Denver, and got a chance to just keep working with him and developing the orchestral side of things that I hadn't done a ton of work on back in Michigan.
Yeah.
So he really encouraged me to give that a shot. And so I did that circuit for about 2 or 3 years auditioning for orchestras and stuff like that. And
it's so cool. I feel like most people, you know, that meet you here, it's like they know you as like the rock drummer on Broadway.
Yeah.
And just like, you know, to hear that you're just an orchestral guy, like you were playing in orchestras.
Yeah.
It's like, holy crap.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
It's pretty cool.
It's and it's funny. It's not as, I don't think it's as different a world as we make it out to be. And I'm sure, you know, just being in the classical side of things, it really isn't, a ton different. The principles they all blend, you know, timekeeping, sound production technique, equipment management, you know, schedule management, all that stuff, you know,
music theories. Still used.
Music theory, how well do you learn? That was the big thing, was the excerpt learning. When you have to learn excerpts, you know, small bits of the big piece of music to audition for the orchestra, you have to learn them a certain, you know, certain way. You have to bring out the certain elements of musicality, and your job is to convince the committee behind your curtain when you're just playing a xylophone lick to hear the rest of the orchestra behind you.
Wow.
You know, convince them, right? Like, the process
is nuts.
Yeah. I will say that about the audition process. The audition process for orchestras are far beyond any audition process I've had for a drum set gig. You know?
So dive into that for me. What does that look like to send that to, you know, like you said, convince that they're hearing the rest?
Yeah. And I should say, I never won a full-time position in an orchestra. You know, I never got to that point. And so, you know, and when I bring it up, I'm more just talking just about the experience. I definitely don't have the answers for how to win a position in an orchestra. But I've got, you know, at least some tools in the arsenal. And I think that's the biggest thing, is having as many tools in your arsenal. Because so many different orchestras are looking for different things. No two orchestras are alike.
Right.
You know, they are all trying to be their own brand of classical music, which I think is a beautiful thing. So the process being, you know, you're behind a curtain, the idea of taking out, you know, gender bias.
It's called a blind audition, right?
Exactly. It's a blind audition. Absolutely.
Because it really should be about the sound quality. I mean, that's...
Absolutely,
that's the whole thing.
And they lay down like a rug, like a big carpet on the floor next to where we'd be sitting in front of the instruments. So that way they can't hear like shoes clacking. Because even that sometimes will have influenced committees in the past. Like if they hear like heels clicking on a stage.
Right.
That might, you know, say, oh, we don't, you know, want to women in the orchestra, which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
So, you know, all these things to take away bias and really... ratchet up the tension, you know, and you're just don't make any noise, don't make any extra sound. You want to sound professional, you want to be professional. And then you go down each and every instrument and they list off 2 or 3 excerpts from larger orchestral works. So there'll be maybe like 10 measures at a time. Some are 20 measures, some are just 5, you know, little tiny licks. And you have to play these excerpts standalone with no orchestra behind you, just you on the stage on their concert hall. which was the cool part about the audition. I got to play on these wonderful halls, even if it were for an audition.
Historic, amazing places.
Yeah, and I play like in Verizon Hall in Philadelphia for their orchestra, the Kauffman Center in Kansas City. Montreal had their stage for their orchestra, and that may be the most beautiful one I've ever played on. And
the gear is usually provided, right?
Yeah.
From the percussion section?
The big gear is. Yeah. So the mallet instruments, so you got vibraphones, marimbas, xylophones. If you have like a bass drum, you have to play a bass drum excerpt or something like that. If you're a timpanist and you're auditioning, you don't have to fly your own timpani to the audition.
Yeah. You bring what, concert snare drum?
Snare drum, sticks. Yeah, snare drum, all your mallets, triangle, tambourine, you know, if you got the small little, you know, ticky-tacky stuff, you bring that. You know, any implements you want to use on the instruments to make your noise, that's on you. Yeah. But even the cymbals, you know, you go and play crash cymbal excerpts, they make you play their cymbals so that there's less bias in sound, you know. But yeah, so you have to go down the, you know, each instrument one by one and play the excerpts. And usually it takes about 6 minutes. Wow. So you have 6 minutes to convince this committee that your sound belongs in the orchestra. Essentially.
And it was always a solo audition, right? Like you were never put with like the percussion section, for example.
I think some orchestras have started doing this thing where they'll actually have you play chamber music, like small ensemble music, as part of your audition with members from the section.
Is that like maybe a later round or just
that's like throughout the finalist round? That's if you get way into the audition, just to see, because a lot of orchestras are starting to do that now where they have these special events where they have, we're going to focus on the we're going to feature the brass of the orchestra. We're going to feature the percussionists and all that stuff. So they want to make sure that you gel and that you're, you know, fun to work with. And, you know, because at the end of the day, it's like, well, it's like Broadway. I mean, you think about Broadway and in a way it's very similar. I mean, I remember my first gig on Broadway was with the guitarist that I work with full time right now. And we're, you know, and wouldn't have imagined that the first gig I get here is someone I'm playing with still, you know. But it was a similar thing. It was the same feeling when I got there. It's like, I got to convince these guys on the first couple tunes. Because you know, after the first song or two, if this guy is the right guy, you know. And at least that's just kind of how I've ended up seeing it at the end. It's like, you know, by the end of the first or second tune, it's like you get a vibe. You know, even if it's a little uncomfortable, it's like you can hear something that you just can't put your finger on.
Intangibles.
Intangibles, yeah. And that's what ends up being with the orchestra stuff too. It's a lot of intangibles. And you look at someone like John Kinsey, whose job is to teach those, you know, and to figure out how to balance teaching those with the technique tangibles and the sound production tangibles, you know, what is concrete and what is not. But yeah, it's very similar, right? Like, I mean, at least.
Yeah, I love that parallel. Yeah. I mean, I've never auditioned for a professional orchestra. I mean, I did my audition for like, it's called the Empire State Youth Orchestra.
Cool.
We talked about this back in my background episode. SEO and you want to say it?
You say it.
NISMA. You know NISMA?
I don't think I do.
New York State Schools. Oh my God, am I going to mess it up? New York State School Music Association?
NISMA.
And it was all those, like you were saying, the I&E competitions and individual.
Yep.
That was quite a debacle when you said that to me the first time.
That was. You still have nightmares about that, right?
Oh, I wake up in a cold sweat at least once a week. NISMA! Okay, it's okay.
You saw me summoning a god.
My therapist is like, don't worry, Nathan. There's no such thing as NISMA.
NISMA can't hurt you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, I totally, I mean, so much respect for you and obviously the, you know, the guys doing it full time. I mean, it's like a serious, there's so much detail and so much time and preparation. I remember being a kid and freaking out about those auditions.
Yeah.
And just being like so scared because you'd have these, ours were not blind. It was just, you know, in a room. And it's like these three guys. I think one of them was, I think my claim to fame is during my audition. I think one of the, it was like a guest judge and he was actually in one of the orchestras. You're laughing.
I'm just, I don't, when anyone starts with my claim to fame, I just, my brain goes wild.
Remembered this, but I crushed the audition. I mean, I made the ensemble, but specifically that judge said he said it was like one of the best snare drum performances that he's heard in that kind of a setting.
Yeah,
I was like, that's cool.
Yeah,
that's
buddy.
That's awesome.
It's a great feeling when you get into a pressure situation like that and you come out the other side in one piece.
Yeah.
You know, the pressure is awful, but then if you do triumph over it, it is better than any low pressure situation.
Yeah.
You know, as nice as those are.
So how many auditions did you do for these and how long does one audition, what's the prep time like? I mean, are we talking a few years in school for that one audition or is it like a few months, would you say?
You know, I mean, like if you want to get kind of the philosophical about it, you know, you're always preparing for an audition.
Right.
But the actual audition doesn't get announced until like they don't announce that the position is open usually until about a couple months before the audition itself.
Yeah.
And that gives people time to send in their resumes. Because first you have to send in a paper resume that they look at, and they screen those, and then they pick the people who they want to come out and play. So they get 500 people usually sending in resumes for one position.
Yeah.
And then they have to whittle that down to 50 people who will actually come and play in the first round, because they just don't have the time to hear everybody, you know. But I think it's a few months out. They'll announce it, and then you send in resumes. They'll put up the audition repertoire list usually when they announce the audition, so people can start preparing either way, you know.
Right.
They can,
so the orchestra provide that list usually.
Yes, the orchestra provides their own personalized, and every orchestra has a different list.
Yeah, there's, and there's like standards, right, that you more or less would see.
Yeah, there's
standards, you know, or whatever it is.
You know, of course, just like Broadway bands saying, what is a Broadway standard? Yeah. Everybody has a different opinion of what a Broadway standard is, you know, or what the standard list is. So you'll see a ton of crossover, and then you'll see this one in there, and it's like, I have no idea what this is.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not available in any of the books of excerpts because it's not public domain. It's one of these newer, some of these orchestras, like Philadelphia, auditioned for them for a substitute position. And I ended up seeing a list that they had for their associate principal percussion audition list. And they were asking you to play excerpts from like John Williams' Sorcerer's Stone soundtrack, because they do so much, you know, concerts for people like that, right? They do these movie scores with the orchestras. They need to know that you can handle that stuff, because those scores are no joke, as you know, you know.
Yeah.
But it's usually a few months for one audition, you know, and if you get accepted through the resume round, then they, you know, say, okay, here's an updated list if they change it, that kind of thing. And then getting your travel in order, you have to go fly out to this gig, you have to pay for the flight, you have to pay for your room and board, you stay with somebody in town if you know somebody in town. And I think that's the craziest part, is you prepare for months for this audition, and most of the time you play the first round and you get cut. And the first round audition is usually about 5 minutes. Right. So you prepare, you play for 5 minutes and you're done, you know, unless you advance to the next round, and then maybe you play for 15 minutes. You know, and if you're lucky, you get to that final round and you play for 45 minutes. You know, they want to hear everything you can do and give you all this opportunity to show off your musicality and things like that. But yeah, it's about a few months or so each time you get an audition. Sometimes you have multiple ones to prepare for. You know, one audition's happening on this date. You got another audition that next month. Two totally different lists, two totally different prep styles, all that kind of thing too. So that maybe is where it gets to be the toughest, when you're having to juggle most, like multiple lists and things like that.
For sure. And did you say you were a sub for the Colorado Symphony?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. And I was very lucky. When I left the school, I was done doing my, you know, in school lessons with John. I always learned from him. And he asked me, you know, are you going to be around? Are you planning on moving somewhere? And I said, well, unless an audition goes well and I win a position, I'll be in Colorado. And he said, well, we're looking to make you one of our first calls.
Yeah.
You know, like put you up at the top of the list. Awesome. And it was great, because I loved everybody in that orchestra. I mean, really, that section felt like family. You know, they really did. And did you ever meet Steve Hearn? He's also a Pearl
I don't think
artist.
I met him. He had my boss's job, I believe, for a while.
Yes, he did. Yeah, he lived here in Nashville.
Seems like the nicest guy. Yeah, I think I'm Facebook friends with him.
Yeah.
But I haven't met him.
He lived here in Nashville too, and he's a section percussion assistant principal timpani. Mm-hmm. You talk about a guy that does everything.
Yeah.
You know, and he can step into just about any section of that percussion section and just
nail it.
Fire. Yeah. Like drum set. I mean, he's one of the best drum set players I've ever met. You know, and he's in the middle of a, you know, in the round concert style hall where there's no funneling, you know, the sound is just going straight up and there's no way to keep time. And he's back there on the drum set just beating the crap out of it, just driving the band, man. It's so cool to see it, you know. Wow. Really cool to watch, you know. So being in that section was a life experience.
Yeah.
You know, just going in there. And I guess it taught me, bigger thing it taught me too, was how you can have a job, but it doesn't have to dominate your life either. You know, because you get in school and it is every day, 8 hours, you're practicing.
Yeah.
In a practice room by yourself. You know, we all still practice, obviously, in our room by ourselves, but it was cool to see them get these jobs and, you know, live somewhat normal lives. You know, the kids, families, that kind of thing. They all had hobbies. They all did stuff outside of work and stuff like that. They come in, you know, we're all dressed in our street clothes, but then they start playing and they transform into, you know, these makers of music and things like that. And it's like, it's just that reminder, you know.
Yeah, I felt that same way, because I met a bunch of those guys at PASIC. Yeah. And like, you know, Leo Soto? Yeah, he's principal with Houston's, or maybe he's not the principal, but
timpanist for Houston, if I remember correctly. Symphony, right?
Yeah. And he's someone that I always want to meet just with my position. Mm-hmm. And just like the coolest guy, like get a drink with him and all these guys, you would never guess that they're like freaking masters of their instruments, you know, I think those are proficient.
Those are the best ones, right? Yeah. Like you walk in the room, you don't see them.
Just wizards.
You can't tell. You can't tell a difference from the rest of the room.
Some of them look like my dad, you know. Like,
exactly. Yeah.
Very unassuming. They dress normally.
I do like someone that you have no idea. I mean, I like that with everything, and I love that in the realm of weightlifting, in the realm of martial arts. Anybody where you look at them, you don't know that they're a beast. Like, yeah. That's because I remember I had a personal trainer at one point, and I was like, yeah, I want to be strong, but I don't want to look strong. He was like, oh, you want to be a sleeper. I was like, sleeper. Yes.
You have a word for that?
I'm like, that's whatever that is. That's what I want.
Yeah, he's like, here, drink this.
Here, drink these drugs.
Have fun being a sleeper.
Yeah. Jeez. Those are my favorite.
Yeah, absolutely. It suggests this security with themselves, right?
Yes.
That they don't have to go out and tell. And that is, bringing it around to Nashville. One of my favorite parts about Nashville is you don't know half the time who in the room with you is one of these guys. And I think that's awesome. You know, I don't think it needs to be that way where
there's never an ego or anything.
You know? No, the ego is completely absent. It's such a wonderful thing, you know. And it's
whenever you encounter someone that feels the need to assert that, not whenever, but it is the exception to the rule that someone feels the need to assert that when they're actually something. Usually, if you're the shit, you don't care.
Right.
Like, yeah, whatever.
Absolutely.
I had someone last night try to get on stage. Wanted to pay $20 to be on stage. I was like, it's $100 to be on stage.
Yeah.
And the guy standing with him goes, you don't know who he is. And I said, nope, I don't care. I'm like, here's the thing. Everybody who is somebody is willing to do like, oh, yeah, man.
Trying to play drums?
Yeah, they're trying to get on stage.
I didn't know you could pay to play like that.
Oh, yeah. On not at every venue.
Yeah.
Some venues don't allow it for insurance, but that at Tootsie's you absolutely can. It's up to the band. But I'm like, no, dude, you're not. You don't even know who he is. I'm like, I don't care who he is. If he was somebody that I should care about,
I would know.
I'd either know or they would be willing. They'd be like, yeah, man, no problem. Because
they'd be cool.
They've been through this shit too. Yeah. Obviously, he hasn't. So fuck off.
You're flipping the bird, right?
Yeah.
I'm just like, I think, speaking of ego and talking about the orchestra, you reminded me, my favorite moment with the orchestra, with subbing with them, kind of, you know, bring it all together. But my favorite moment with the orchestra is I got to play at Red Rocks with them.
Oh, so awesome. Cool.
I got to play Red Rocks with the symphony. I was lucky enough to be one of their calls for this concert. And they were backing up Weird Al Yankovic.
What?
Yes! It was amazing.
Oh, my God!
If there's... Hey, who would you want to play with at Red Rocks? And it's like, duh. Yeah. You know, and it was so funny. Talking to my neighbor, percussionist, who was like a couple years older than me, and he had won a position in the symphony, and he was, you know, just a couple years old. So around that, you know, 30, 31. And I remember standing on the stage in rehearsal, getting ready to set up for the rehearsal. And he looks at me and said, did you ever listen to Weird Al's music growing up? I looked at him, I said, absolutely. Yeah. And he looks back at me and says, I know every word to his songs.
Yeah,
and he's like, don't tell anybody. I was like, nah, I won't promise, you know. But it was wild because, you know, he comes out and he's doing his rehearsal and he's doing all his show stuff. And we went backstage and they have catering services at Red Rocks. You just go right in the back of the stage and it's one of the best catering services in the world. Like, ridiculous.
Big surprise.
You would think they would. Sometimes they just don't, you know.
Right.
But they do, you know, they make it the best. And, we're sitting there and there's this table, this open table. Weird Al sits down at the table and it's him and his manager, and he, I don't think, looked up once from his food. And it was just very insular.
Oh, weird.
Very
so
quiet.
He was
and
no personality?
And no, not even so much like no personality. It wasn't even like rude.
Yeah.
I did not get one rude vibe from this man. He's probably, I think he really is generally maybe the nicest famous person in the world.
He is.
I think part of that is, I mean, that's got to wear on someone, you know what I mean? And like looking at, you know, the orchestra and they're all, you know, talking and sitting at tables and conversing, and they're, you know, he's there at the table by himself, you know, on his tour and all that, and he's with his manager, you know.
Yeah.
And it was wild to see that, you know, coming to a place where the industry is the industry and it's the city, you know.
Yeah.
It's an interesting perspective, you know, and I feel that some days.
Yeah.
Of, you know, you get off stage and it's like, okay, I'm going home. You know, and when you get done playing with the orchestra, it's a very similar thing where you're done with the concert, you know, you're on the stage, you're in your suits, and, you know, everyone applauds, you stand up, you know, you recognize the applause at the end of the program. Lights come up, we all walk off stage, go to the locker rooms, change into day clothes, we go out the back door, and you blend right into the rest of the
city. Yeah, the game's over.
Wouldn't even know. You know, you wouldn't even know half these people were in the center.
You've
just
done your
playing.
Job and not. Yep. Go home.
And you wouldn't even know that they're playing. And it's like they go home and they come back the next day and do it. And it was this kind of a surreal experience every single time I played with that orchestra.
Yeah.
Of just like, yeah, I'm just a normal person.
Was like, that for you kind of like a I've arrived moment?
Wasn't even an I've arrived moment. It was a reminder that no matter if you've arrived or not, you're just another person.
Right.
Oh, at the end of the day, you're just another person.
That's wonderful.
It was in a beautiful way, right?
Yeah.
It's a very calming, very, you know, centering feeling of no matter what, man, like, and then that goes both ways. It's like, hey, man, you got a big ego. You got to remember you're just another person. But then there's also like, if you feel like you're screwing stuff up or you feel like you're just, man, I'm just not doing it today. And then you get done and it's like, I'm just another guy.
I gotta pick up milk on the way home.
I get done playing a 4-hour set and everyone's like, you're the best band ever. And it's like, yeah, but I forgot to shut off my stove. You know, my dishwasher leaked yesterday. And I felt very human in that moment. Yeah. You know? I did not feel like anything, like I've made it in any way, you know? And it's like, there's humbling moments all the time, you know? And especially watching someone like him, even just having to be that quiet. You know, it was wild.
Yeah.
You know, and I was, there's part of me wanted to go up and ask him for an autograph. And then I saw that and I was like, you know what? That's probably the rudest thing I could do right now.
Yeah.
Mm. Like, no, this is enough. Me seeing him and getting to play on the same stage.
Getting to play with him.
That is more than enough. I don't need to get him to sign something for proof. It's like, no, man, that's living,
you have the story
that's
now.
Living with me,
you
know what I mean? Man.
Yeah.
Right. You know, that is going right here.
Yeah.
The best part was I played maybe the first couple tunes and that's all they needed the extra percussion part for. So.
What tunes did you play?
It was his intro song, and I think it was Amish Paradise. I played Glockenspiel on Amish Paradise.
Oh, my God.
Okay.
We need a video.
I've peaked.
Nerding out.
I've peaked. Yeah, so.
It's only down from here.
That's it. It's done. And but the cool thing was after that, I was done, and I remember one of the percussionists in the orchestra said, hey, it's really cool. Like, you'll be done after the second tune. You don't have to stick around. Like when you're done with anything, even at your regular concert, you know, if you play just on the first tune of their concert, you're done. You don't have to stay and you get paid the same amount, which is kind of wild. So
they don't expect you to help with tear down or anything?
It's union. So they have stagehands do everything for you, except for the small stuff, of course.
Right,
but
no,
if you're done, and unless I think at the last concert, you stick around to grab your stuff, you know, or you just do it, or you do it at the intermission, and then you're done. And
so you just enjoyed the rest of that concert then?
Oh, yeah. I did not go home. You know, he was like, you can beat the Red Rocks traffic. I'm like, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah, I want to stay in the Red Rocks.
I'm in Red Rocks. I'm going to spend as much time as I can in Red Rocks, you know. And they have staircases on the sides of the stage in the back. And they built the dressing rooms into the rock. So like the dressing rooms are literally,
I need to get there.
It's ridiculous.
Taylor's been there. Have you been there?
Yeah. No.
No?
Never been.
That's come up a few times. But
it's funny because like I don't really necessarily, I haven't had like, because I've been asked like, what's like bucket list venue for you? I'm like, I don't know. But now after enough of these conversations about like
pictures.
Okay, that's on there. Gotta play Red Rocks.
It is 100% as advertised.
Yeah.
Just ridiculous. And you know, and you're standing on the stage and the seats are just vaulted, you know, just up into the mountain.
Do you know the capacity about?
5,000 or 6,000.
Okay.
Some, it's all bench seating, so it's you know, somewhat flexible. But I think they sell, I think 5,000 or 6,000 is their capacity.
Yeah.
But yeah, and they had these staircases going up into these dressing rooms, and I stood on that staircase from up above backstage, right about here, just looking down on the stage, watching it, and watching in between every single song, Weird Al runs off the stage and a team of 4 people rip the costume off and put a new costume on in 30 seconds.
Yep.
And he is back out for his next song dressed like the song. It's stupid.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Can you imagine if they did that for you guys with the bow ties, right?
Yeah, you seriously.
New bow tie. And
it's like, okay, for this piece, you have to be wearing, you know, all black. And this piece, you have to be wearing a tuxedo. And this piece, you're wearing a swimsuit. You know, it's like.
This one, you're wearing your Aloha shirt. And the next one, you're going to be wearing a fat costume.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's,
but I'm playing triangle. Why do I need. Right. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, this is the dedication. We're just stupid.
Yeah.
It was the same when I saw him in Reading back a million years ago. I got front row center.
No
way. So it was the best. And during that's your horoscope for today. What he's like looking the most manic a human can possibly look. And there's that moment where all your friends are laughing behind your back.
Kill them.
he looked directly into my eyes. And imbued me with some of his powers and a lot of his weirdness. And I've been blessed by it ever since.
That makes sense. That's why you're weird.
Yeah.
It's because of Weird Al. Yeah.
That's a deep Running with Scissors cut. Weird Al. I didn't expect to talk about Weird Al today. That's great.
I actually have, do you know Alex Dolezal?
I don't think so, no.
Piano player here in town. He actually runs a comedy night. One of the funniest and sweetest human beings here. Fantastic musician. He has a running joke on his Instagram every Thursday. TBT, when I met Weird Al. And it's a picture of him with Weird Al.
Yeah.
And he tags Weird Al and every, and he's like, I'm going to do, he's been doing it for years. He's like, I'm doing it until he notices. I'm like, yeah. So I need to find a way.
Yeah.
I want to do, because I saw that Weird Al did some birthday shout out for someone. I'm like, I want
to
find that.
You need to find out.
Yeah.
What that costs.
Cameo. Or you get him a cameo from Weird Al. Say, hey, I noticed.
Like, I just, like, I need to have him be like, hey, for his next birthday, be like, okay, this is the thing. And you have to say that you saw the thing. Like, that's the move.
Yeah. But you can, so many people do that. Like, those cameos, you can get just about anybody to do those things for the right, if it's the right price,
right,
you know,
yeah.
And,
right.
And like, depending on their tier, I guess,
of right.
cost, you know.
What's that you said? You want to learn how to play drums, but you don't know where to begin? Let me humbly suggest to you that you head on down to Music Lab Nashville and you talk to their crew of fantastic teachers and you jump on in and start your music journey right there. Don't want to learn drums? Want to learn guitar? Ukulele? Mandolin? Trumpet? Vocals? Keys? Sitar? Maybe not sitar, but all that other stuff for sure. Visit nashville.musiclab.co to learn more and sign up for a free trial lesson.
Okay, so I have to ask.
Yes.
And I think we can probably move on from the orchestral stuff.
Or, yeah.
You know, but I'm definitely still interested to learn more, you know, if you have other stories or whatever.
We'll talk over.
Yeah, man.
About bourbon, whenever Nathan remembers bourbon. To bring it. Yeah.
Just quick, like, obviously as an orchestral percussionist and you're doing these additions, like, you have to be prepared on every instrument, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did you gravitate towards, like, a specific thing? Like, you mentioned glockenspiel, mallets, snare drum, bass drum.
You know, it's funny, actually. I would say I didn't necessarily gravitate to one specific instrument because you kind of know everyone pretty equally. And so there's something to love about all of them.
Yeah.
I know that's a really cheap answer.
Like for me, with my story, I already told you, like, snare drum was like...
Snare drum,
I think because I was a drum set guy, so it was the natural
Absolutely.
To take out the snare from the kit and have that.
I think I gravitated towards more of like a type of music. And it was like playing in chamber ensembles.
Yeah.
Like that, if I could have done that, and it just shows now I'm playing in bands for full time. You know, I mean, if I could have done that for a living... Honestly, like the orchestras were great, but if I could have played in a small, like, 4-person chamber ensemble, like, so percussion.
Dude, yes.
You know,
I wanted to
sandbox.
Start one. I still would love to do that.
Yeah, and, like, sandbox percussion, like, all those guys, like, they are, I respect those guys so much.
Yeah, you know? Sandbox is insane.
Oh, my God.
All those, Third
you watch
Coast.
Seven Pillars? Have you seen their
I saw it live at PASIC.
You gotta watch
that
this.
That was the premiere,
Dude, all your, the polyrhythm
you
stuff, get, all that. Dude, you are,
you have
yes,
no
you
idea
gotta
what
watch
we're,
this, man.
I'm taking notes. This is my note. What are they called?
Seven Pillars, well, specifically that, but Sandbox Percussion. I'll send you some of these groups.
If you want to pick one of them, I'd say probably Four. It's probably the big hit, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Pillar Four.
Yeah.
That was the one that was, it's by a composer named Andy Akio.
Yeah, that guy's, anything that guy touches turns to gold.
Dude, I mean, talking about a brain, man. Like, he's got a mind on him.
And they're all young. I mean, Andy's pretty young. Sandbox is young.
Mm-hmm.
You look at some of those pioneers, like, you know, Third Coast Percussion.
Yeah. And so they were
Nexus,
all, they were all young when they did that
Third
stuff.
Coast
That's
Percussion.
The cool thing.
You know Amadinda?
Yeah, absolutely.
They're doing one of the showcase concerts this year.
No way.
So we got a whole list of gear that we're going to help them out for.
Gotta see they better play Jose before John. They got to play Jose before John.
You said Nexus Percussion too?
Nexus, they're retired. Let's continue on with your journey. I'm just so fascinated with your background. So you mentioned you're studying with John.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to us about that transition. You know, you're going through those auditions. You had that amazing, you know, substitute gig with the symphony. And because you said John was the one that convinced you to move to Nashville, right? Or he kind of pushed you, you said?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of kind of, I think everybody here I've met in Nashville has a reason for being here. That's not music related. It seems like. Everybody's got a story. Like, I don't know. Everyone seems to have a story. Like, everyone I've talked to has like a real, like, I was doing this thing back in my hometown and then something happened, you know, it really pushed me to go to Nashville. And COVID was tough, you know, for everybody, I think, you know, and for musicians everywhere. And I was not excluded from that. You know, it was really difficult. And there was, you know, there's kind of a tough time, you know, overall. And I had just recently started playing at a church out there, playing drum set for a modern church, you know, kind of worship. Got to know some of them kind of briefly. It was just kind of starting to get to know them, and then COVID hit. I was playing with the orchestras. All those concerts got shut down. Yeah. I mean, all these cool programs.
Yeah, the orchestras got hit probably hardest, you know.
Big
what I mean?
Time, man. And they're still recovering. You know, a lot of them are still recovering. And you know, there are all these things that I was looking forward to. Yeah, I think everybody, you know, all these things. And I had this chamber ensemble, like I was talking about with a friend of mine, Ben, and we had 3 weeks before come off of a tour, and we got in just at the last minute. Like it wouldn't have even happened.
Yeah.
You know, if we had scheduled our tour a month later, never would have happened. You know, and we toured some colleges and toured some like public spaces and stuff like that and played our program. And we were really exploring at the time, you know, music and voice, you know, percussion and voice, how we can like incorporate, you know, speaking things and, you know, that kind of stuff into our program and stuff like that with playing, you know, percussion stuff. And I took the Kansas City Symphony audition. And then I think it was like 5 days after I took that audition, everything started to shut down.
Yeah.
You know, long story short is, you know, I hit July and August around the time when I'm thinking, okay, by that point, we'll all figure this out. We'll figure out what's going on and, you know, we'll move on and blah, 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 blah. And of course that didn't happen. And the orchestra was like, you know, we're not really starting up a season. It's going to be a truncated season. And we, because of that, we're doing smaller ensembles, spaced out ensembles. We don't need our subs as much, you know? And so it's like, I don't even know when this is going to happen. You know, who knows when this will happen, if ever. And that at the time, you know, of course, now we know that they've started back up and a lot of them are functioning well. A lot of them have gotten back, you know, into their regular programming. But at that time it was I don't know if this is ever going to happen. You know, and it was, I remember vividly July, August of 2020 sitting in my room and not making music.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is not right. You know, there's got to be something I can do. And I, in a moment of pure desperation, I went onto Craigslist and was
as
like,
one does.
I heard some of my friends found gigs doing this. And I was like, I'm going to give this a shot, you know? And so I look up, you know, drum set, you know, all that, you know, just drummer, drum set, whatever. And one of the searches I did turned up, I remember third result, and it was, you know, working band needs a drummer. And I clicked on it, it's all caps, you know, I'm thinking, okay, we'll see, you know, but I click on it and it seems legit. It doesn't seem like a fake ad. It doesn't seem like they're lying. It seems like, no, they're serious. They have some gigs lined up at places that are allowing limited capacity type stuff. And I was like, cool, let's see what this is. And it was a band called Final Eyes. Spelled out Final Eyes.
Yep.
And it was this group of like middle-aged people, like 40, 50-year-olds in a five-piece band. And they had made their living for years on the side doing these wedding band gigs and these corporate gigs and these bar gigs. And they were still trying to work, you know, they're still trying to have gigs, you know, and it was, you know, I was surrounded by a lot of people that weren't working, you know, and just couldn't or didn't want to, either one, you know. And they were, and I was like, I still want to go out and do something, you know, in whatever context I can do it in at this point, you know? And they said, well, come on over. Here's, go check out our song list. And
that was back in Colorado. Right?
That was back in Denver. Yeah. And, you know, I had contemplated moving to Denver back in 2019. I was thinking about moving in 2020 and it kind of like, you know, put the kibosh to things. And, so I go and audition for this band and they're like, you know, I'll bring some tunes. But one specific thing they told me was they said, we're looking for someone who can sing some songs. And I was like, well, I can sing. I've sung before. Like, I've never really done the drumming singing thing before, but yeah, I'll give it a shot. Like, I'll pick some songs that I know really well. And one of the ones that they had they had a bunch of normal, you know, Jesse's Girl and, you know, Summer 69 and all these tunes. And so I picked a couple of normal and they had Hold the Line by Toto on the list. And I was like, dude, I got to do this. I love that song, you know, and I know it just note for note. I grew up, it was one of my favorite songs growing up as a kid. And I was like, yeah, why not? Let's see if they know how to play it. And I get there and I remember it was, he's like, oh, really sorry. Our keyboard and bassist player couldn't make it. But me, the guitarist and the singer, their husband and wife, and they're like, well, we're here, you know, we can do whatever you need to do. Let's see how you do. And it was me on an electric kit in their basement, him on his guitar, her with her microphone, the little PA system in their basement. And they're like, well, what do you want to play? And I was like, I saw you do Toto on there. And they're like, you want to play Toto? And I was like, yeah, I want to play Toto. Do you know? And he's like, well, we don't have the keyboard player. We'll just like skip the intro. You know, the intro is all piano and we'll skip that. And so I just played it and sang it and, you know, as best as I could. And, you know, I remember a few months down the road after they said I could be in the band and play with them. And I realized that it was me and four other middle-aged people, you know, but they were working and they were doing everything they could to still work, you know, within the context of what we had, you know, and with the situation in Denver. And it was like these wonderful, you know, people, you know, 20 years my senior with all this life and energy, Yeah. And it was like, it picked me out of my doldrums immediately,
yeah.
you know, and it gave me something to do. And it gave me a challenge. Like, it gave me a challenge to really practice that skill, you know, something I'd never done before. And like, I was able to sing some songs that they just, you know, the female singer couldn't sing or something like that, or the one other male singer couldn't sing. So it could help round out their set,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it was like, we got 2 months into the gig and they had hired a brand new bass player and keyboard to find out that they were thinking of disbanding this band. Like, they were like, we didn't like the lineup we had before. And the guitar player's like, I'm just kind of sick of it. Let's just not do this. And his wife is like, no, you know what? Give it one more shot. Let's find a new drummer. Let's find a new bassist and keyboard. Let's just give it one more shot. If it doesn't work out, we're done. You know, we'll call it quits. And those people are family to me still. And Randy passed away in September, the guitar player. And it was a tough time.
Wow.
But they're family, you know, I mean, they really are. I mean, they became just like, we did almost, you know, we were always rehearsing. We rehearsed once a week and, you know, and started adding tunes. Like, maybe we can do this song. Maybe we can do this song. Maybe we can do this song. And it was like, you know, everyone would just come every week, just bring a new song to the table.
Yeah.
They always wanted to play. And you just happen to now be in a band that can handle it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's all like, covers.
You all said? Covers. Yeah. And we were sort of doing like Come Sail Away. Because we had a keyboard player and he had downloaded the actual synth patch that Dennis DeYoung used on the
nice. Album.
And so it's like, we're doing everything to the record, you know, and it's, again, that instilling all these things that when you come out here, you kind of need to have that, you know, from the start, you know, with the Broadway gigs is learning tunes, you know, accurately and quickly. And they forced me to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it was like, we got a gig, we're going to learn these, you know, 10 tunes for the next gig, you know, and all this stuff. And it's 2 days away. But yeah, that was kind of the transition point. Was that. And it was, there was no other work happening. And I kind of had to just take what I could get.
Yeah.
And it ended up being work where I was sitting there, I'm like, and I was talking to a therapist at the time. And I remember a conversation with her where she, you know, we were talking about, why are you here in these appointments? And I was like, well, you know, I had a lot of plans and COVID shut them down. And I'm trying to figure out how to kind of rationalize and deal with this and mentally handle it and, you know, all this stuff. And I said, you know, I had plans to kind of move to Nashville and that kind of really put the kibosh to it. I don't think, you know, it's not going to happen, you know. And she said, yeah, this time has definitely killed a lot of plans. She said, on the other hand, this could accelerate your plans. And I was like, oh, I hadn't thought about it that way.
Yeah.
And I started to realize with all of this stuff not happening, it was not like I was having to necessarily cut as thick of a tie in a lot of ways. And I didn't feel like I had to cut the ties. You know, mm-hmm. and there are a lot of the, you know, the kind of like explaining, almost like explaining yourself or rationally, it's like, look, I have to go where I think the work is going to be. And at the time it was like, I think I can probably find more work in like certain work in Nashville. And this, I think, is it, you know, this is the time. And again, it landed the day I moved was the first day Denver really started to open back up. You know, and I was like, it was like 4 months after I joined this band and I'm telling them, yeah, I think I'm moving to Nashville. And they're like, what are you talking about? Like, what do you mean you're leaving? You know, you just joined.
Yeah.
We're having so much fun. And I was like, yeah, that was the one like active, really active at the moment. It wasn't like the symphony wasn't active. And I had to say goodbye to John and Steve and all those guys. And that was hard.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also just like, these things aren't happening. I don't know what my school job is going to look like next year. I might not have a job next year.
Yeah.
You know, I have to go where I think I can find those things. So it was born out of necessity first. And then I realized, God, I really love doing this.
Yeah.
You know, oh my gosh, I gotta go do this. You know? And they gave me this new, helped me find this kind of space in the world that I didn't really have before. Or felt like I didn't have before, you know,
it's really
cool. Like I owe a lot to those guys.
Wow. What a cool story, man.
Yeah.
Always respect thank your you for elders, sharing man, that. You know?
Yep.
Wow. I was thinking a lot about different things when you were sharing that, just being vulnerable and like, but good on you for being so open-minded. It's like you were literally at the pit of your despair, you had nothing going on. And
and it was like, you know, you don't have a choice. You don't have a choice at those times.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be open-minded. You have to be like, well, okay, what's going to happen? You don't know what's happening next. I mean, that's the ultimate in having to be flexible, right?
You know, being willing to sing.
It's like, so much fun.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, now look at you, right? That's what you're doing now, right? Like you're actively singing and drumming.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
That's crazy.
It's so much fun though. It's a lot of fun.
I mean, you kind of found yourself in those dark times, it sounds like, before moving here.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. It was definitely, they definitely gave me the chance to like try something new.
Yeah.
With that safety net of, don't worry, it's okay if it doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's totally cool. Yeah, I mean, like, we're all trying to figure this out, you know? And then once you figure it out, just allowing me to roll with it too, you know?
Yeah.
I mean? And allowing me to have that voice, you know? And I think that, like, I was thinking about on the way over, preparing as much as I could on my end for you guys too, but you know, I think every drummer should try singing, like at some point in their lives, even if it's not while they're drumming.
Yeah.
You know, they should just try it, you know, and just give it a shot. You know, you'd be amazed. Some of the drummers who I've met up and they're like, I don't really sing. And then they put a microphone in front of them. And I'm like, dude, you sound amazing.
Yeah.
And like, how have you not done this yet? You know, not for, all marketability and job, you know, situation, money wise, aside of like, you'll be more applicable and hireable. It's like, no, forget that part of it. It's like, it's so much more fun to sing a song and times, you know, and in doing so too, it teaches you a totally different way to learn a song.
Yes,
you
it
know,
does.
You listen to the vocal. If you listen to the vocal first, it's amazing. You learn the form of the song immediately.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you listen to the drum part, you can feel it and all that, you know, but that vocalist drives a lot of the form and like, where is this going? Can I detect the energy? Like when I'm on stage, I don't necessarily read charts.
Right.
I pull up AZ Lyrics and I read lyrics off of a page and you can see the sections and you can see where's the repeated text. You know, okay, here's the repeated text. That must be the chorus. There's the title of the song. That must be the chorus. So when I see that text coming up, it's almost like playing karaoke. You see the like highlighted text coming. Yep. It's like, here it comes. This is going to be it. So at least you get to that point faster, I think, even in some ways.
Yeah.
And then you can jump on the chorus and, you know, lay in and know that you're going to hit that chorus and stuff like that. And it sets you up for the like, oh, there's an extra bar here. But at least you knew that turn was coming and you knew that weird things happened in that turn.
Yes.
So I would just say to anyone who's a drummer is listening or anybody really, any instrumentalist, like just try singing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so much fun. Yeah.
Well, and you can, this made me think this, singers often, and I think rightfully so, in a lot of cases get roasted for like lack of understanding of rhythmic things and being kind of all over the place with rhythms. But they learn, like you said, you brought it up, they learn songs differently. And like and putting yourself in that singer headspace, just like when I first started, because I would not call myself like an excellent bassist by any stretch, but when I first started picking up bass, and just from picking it up going, oh, I know what I would want from a drummer.
Yep.
Absolutely. I know what I would want, so I'm not gonna ruin that for any bass player I'm playing with. I really want to make sure I'm providing that thing.
Absolutely.
Doing that as a singer is gonna let you know what a singer is gonna want from a drummer.
Yeah,
that's like, so valuable.
It feeds the other thing. It's all synergistic. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and like quick shout out to my bandmates of like, you know, Shannon Sproul and Brian Snyder for, again, allowing me to figure some of this out on the job and like, you know, doing things that, you know, they wouldn't have done in the past or, you know, and then just being so open, you know what I mean? And like, just being so willing to work with me and then like understanding, you know, and I always try to make sure I understand, you know, what is Ryan doing on his guitar? What strings are you using? Like, what is your pickup situation? What is your this and that? Like, I want to know what sounds he's producing. You know, it's the learning thing, right? It all comes back to learning where, you know, and the singer too, of just like, you know, trying to make sure I know exactly what she's singing every time.
Yeah.
Because then I might add that rhythm on a snare drum. You know, I'll come in, it's like, okay, I'm going to add a hit here. And when you're in a Broadway situation where you're in a box, you know, and the sound is not necessarily good every time. Right. It's like, you got to add some other elements in there to provide cohesion to your sound.
Yes.
And if you're just a three piece, you got to do all sorts of things to make it sound full. And you can only do that if you're really aware, not just of listening to the vocalist and the guitarist, but really knowing how their instruments function.
Right.
You know, how does the guitar function? What guitar is he using? What's his tone production method? What's his, you know, is he using a compression tube pedal? You know, is he, you know, is the singer, you know, how is she feeling today? And what key does she want this in? You know, what key is she singing it versus the record? You know, what other extra melismas is she adding in? Like that I can then put something on top of that, you know? And so it's like, get yourself bandmates who communicate with each other.
Yeah.
Just do it.
You know? Oh, man.
Like, get yourself bandmates that will communicate, you know, and
that's
talk
a word.
Outside of the band, outside of the gigs. I mean, get yourself bandmates who want to hang out and like really dial in and get to know each other on a deep level.
Mm-hmm.
Because I mean, dude, so many things get solved if you do, you know?
It's true.
Like the singer so well, you know, the guitar player's personality, you know exactly what he's going to do on that stage.
Yes.
And man, that's so applicable too, to bring it back to your roots as the orchestral percussionist. Mm-hmm. And you probably felt that more heavily with the chamber. group, right? I mean, you guys are essentially a band.
Absolutely. But
then even, you know, with a professional orchestra, it's like when you're playing, especially when you're playing like a triangle part, let's say, you're resting for 80 bars. I mean, you got to know what the hell is going on in that orchestra.
You don't know.
If there's a vocalist, you know, you got to know her part. You look at the trumpet section, like it's all cues from the orchestra.
Right.
You know?
It's way easier to play in an orchestra and deal with all that like resting and all that stuff if you just know how the piece goes.
Yeah. Right.
So you don't have to count. Yeah, I remember being on the stage playing Scheherazade with John the one day. And, you know, I turned a page earlier and someone like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to turn to pages. And he's like, dude, I know what's coming. And I'm like, you do know what's coming. Yeah. He's played this thousands of times.
Right.
He has that whole, he had every section of the orchestra memorized, you know? And it's like, it's so much more fun. Yeah. I know some people think of it, they dread the work or they all that stuff. And it's work some days. But at the end of the day, man, it's like, it's so much more fun when you know what's going on in the band.
Oh,
You know all the little things.
Yeah.
You know something that someone else doesn't. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something to be said about that.
Yeah.
We had, I remember when I was in school at Central, there was the 40th anniversary of this event that our school music put on called Jazz Weekend. And it was the jazz department's chance to have like the whole school music to themselves, essentially. And they would send bring in 30 or 40 different high schools would send their kids jazz bands and jazz combos. And they'd do like a solo and ensemble band festival type thing where they get ratings, they get prizes, you know, placed and stuff like that. And they'd have a guest artist every year who would put on a concert at the end of the festival.
Yeah.
A featured concert, like 2-hour length jazz, large jazz band concert with our jazz ensemble. And our jazz teacher had that band cooking, man. I mean, it was like 1 o'clock band style, North Texas style music. But Jeff Hamilton was the guest.
Oh!
He brought his entire trio.
Yep.
It was him and Tamir and Christoph. Christoph was a bass player at the time. There are two things I remember from that weekend. And one was that a similar thing when he was playing the charts and you could see him singing all the hits. He was singing everything. And he knew every single chart, like the back of his hand.
Yeah.
Not just drum-wise. But he knew a lot of the arrangements were him and Mark Clayton's, you know, so they were his arrangements that he was singing. But, you know, the Eternal Triangle, John Coltrane, Coltrane, I think. And it's like, you have to know how to sing that to be able to play along. You can't not, you know, there's not really another option.
Yeah.
And then the second part of it was we had the day where the kids were coming in and a lot of them stayed at hotels because they'd be coming up from like Detroit to Mount Pleasant, Michigan. It's like a 2.5-hour drive. Then the next day, they do the whole event, concert in the night. And that Thursday night, the night before the event was supposed to happen, I think like a foot of snow dropped on Mount Pleasant and the university closed.
Oh, man.
It was the 40th anniversary year of this event.
Yeah.
And the school closed. And a bunch of the Phi Mu Alpha people from the fraternity were running, helping to like sponsor it and host it, got together and said, what can we do? And so a lot of the kids weren't able to come, unfortunately, because they didn't come that day. A lot of them couldn't make it. But the ones that were there were like stranded in this town. They're getting a foot of snow dumped on them. You know, they can't get their buses out.
Right.
And they're stuck at this hotel. And so they end up renting out the conference rooms at the hotel. They went to the hotel, say, can we like get a deal? And they're just like, no, just have them, you know, like just take them.
Mm-hmm.
No one else is using them today. And they filled out the conference rooms. The professors from the university who are going to be judging these things came over and judged. You know, and gave some like, you know, not awards, but gave ratings and comments and stuff. So the kids got to play their sets still.
Yeah, that's cool.
And then the best part was they went to Jeff and they said, dude, university's closed. We don't have a space. They said, are you okay if we like look for another space? I mean, it's not part of your contract. You know, it's just, I'm sorry. You know, it's going to be what we can make. And he's like, do whatever you got to do. We'll be there. He was like, wherever you need me, just let me know, essentially. And so few words.
Yeah.
And they ended up going to the local, it's called the Ward Theater. And it was this old converted movie theater that was used as like a church. So they'd set up, you know, chairs on the concrete. But then they used it for these jazz events. And they set up just like last minute, got all this equipment over from the school, got all of Jeff's stuff over there and his got a piano set up. Yeah, the piano was set up in tune and all that. Sound system, someone to run the sound system. And they set up all the chairs that weren't set up before. And it was like, the concert would have been in the large auditorium on campus. Yeah. So big auditorium, big stage, you know, big all that.
Thousands of people.
And it was now in this tiny little theater. And it was snowing outside. It was cold. And we were shoulder to shoulder packed in this little tiny theater just on top of the stage. And the second half of the concert was just Jeff and his trio. And it was magical. And it was the testament to you make the god dang concert happen.
Yeah, yeah, you do. You
what a cool story.
And it was way cooler a concert than it would have been.
And the whole trio showed up, right?
The whole trio, yeah. A way cooler concert than it would have been if it would have been at the big auditorium.
Oh,
yeah.
It means more so when it's more. Like that.
Yeah. I was brought to tears numerous times during that trio performance. He was playing, I don't know, there's this old AM radio song called On and On by Stephen Bishop. Have you ever heard this song? It's beautiful, this beautiful just kind of rumination on like, you know, just loneliness essentially. But it's an AM radio with like congas and wind chimes and, you know, very Christopher Cross. Yeah. And, but he played.
So smooth.
Dude, so smooth. You know, and, but one of the most beautiful songs in the world. And they played a trio arrangement of this with his band. And it came on and that was a song that like my parents had on one of their mixtapes when we go on road trips. And I was just in the mess in the crowd, you know,
oh
just
my God.
Like. You know, and so it's like, again, you just don't know what's going to happen until you got to make the concert happen. You can't just say, too bad, you know, it's just circumstances.
Yeah, sorry, guys.
Circumstances, you know what I mean? Like, I think COVID taught that a lot of us. It's like, you can say circumstances.
Being malleable, being flexible, and just trying to do the right thing.
You can say, circumstances say, but boy, it's always better when you say, no, I think there's a way we can.
I love that.
You know, so it's like, it just reminded me of that with the.
What a cool story.
Yeah.
So talk to us about Too Hot for Leather, right?
Yeah.
Is that your band or did you join as the drummer when you moved here?
It formed in pieces. I mean, Ryan's lived here for 6 years, if I remember correctly. He'll correct me if I'm wrong, definitely. It's six years and a few months. And I moved in 2021. So he'd been here a long time. And he was playing with another band and doing mostly like original stuff. And he was working, you know, day jobs and service industry stuff. And he had a similar, just, I think he had a similar kind of track where it's like, you know, coming out of the pandemic and he's like, no, you know what? I'm going to make music my full-time thing. I don't want to work service industry more. I want to be a full-time musician and I just got to do it. And so it was right around the time that I moved that he started doing this and started picking up gigs at Lucky Bastard Saloon. The story there is he got a music video filmed pretty recently before that. One of his original tunes that he's going to be releasing soon with his EP. Plugging his EP in. He'll be super. I don't know why I get closer to the mic when I say things like this.
That's good. But
no, it's fun.
It's secretive.
Yeah. Let's talk. Just you and me.
Welcome to All Things Considered. This is. So he had just gotten a music video filmed by one of my old high school friends, Adam Eubank. And Adam Eubank was one of the guys that convinced me to move to Nashville. And he like let me stay at his house when I came out to visit. I came out during like November 2020 during the pandemic. Like I flew out here and like visited and just like just to be out here. Like I didn't do a bunch of things. I didn't go out to a bunch of places. There weren't a bunch of things to do. But I just wanted to be out here. I had some friends making music. I made some music with those friends while I was here. And it was just kind of like I remember sitting that November just in their living room sitting there. And I looked at him and his wife and I'm like, yeah, that's it. I'm moving to Nashville. Like, and they're just like, are you serious? You're doing it? He's like, we got to start looking for housing. You know, it's like immediately, you know, like I'm going to help you looking for an apartment. So that's that guy. He's the one who filmed Ryan's video. And so Adam, from the minute I got there, he's like, hey, I was trying, as I've learned, you know, and I'm sure we can commiserate about this, but I was trying to join the Nashville Gig Finder Facebook page.
Ha!
As one does.
And it took me until, I think, September of 2021 to join the page.
Oh my God, dude.
Until I found out about the Not So Lame page. And of course, you know, that's where I've done all my work since, you know. Shout out to Will Gustafson and et cetera, et cetera. But
For some reason, by the way, my wife blocked from Nashville Gig Finder.
It seems like a lot of people are. It's like weird. For reasons unknown.
Yep.
Unbeknownst to mankind.
I talked to, I can't remember the guy's name who made Gig Finder, but I was like, hey, my wife is blocked.
What's the scoop button? Yeah.
And she was never a member. He was like, no, I don't know why she's blocked. I'm like, can you unblock her? No, I can't. I was like,
sure.
Okay. Goodbye now. Yeah. All right, see ya. There's a reason why there's literally a page called Not So Lame Gig
Finder. I don't think I'm part of that.
Yeah, it's
like a secret thing.
I can tell you this, it is Not So Lame.
Yeah. If you want gigs, go to Not So Lame.
No, I mean, that's where it all happens. Yeah. I mean,
I've heard of it.
Yeah, obviously, stuff happens in every page, but most of it happens there now. So I couldn't get in there. And I was telling Adam, he's like, I don't know what's going on. I didn't know what was going on at the time. I didn't
invite you to it right now.
Yeah, I'm a member of it now.
Oh, sorry. Him.
Oh, him? Yeah. But
I'll make it lame.
Yeah. Oh, dang. Dan's here now.
Oh, come on.
This is all another going so drummer. Well. Yeah. But yes, I wasn't a part of the group and I couldn't get in. And I was just like, dude, I don't know what the heck's going on. I'm just trying to get gigs. And yeah. And I'd already picked up one gig from, I think it was Nashville Musician Fire.
So just to back it up a second. So when you first moved to Nash, you went right to Broadway and you were just doing that full time?
I didn't know anybody.
You didn't really have any gigs yet, right?
I didn't have any gigs. Yeah. It was just kind of, when I moved to Denver, I did a similar thing. I didn't have any work. I had the school thing kind of lined up to do some educating my own, but I didn't have any work lined up. I just found work when I got there. So I was like, done it once before, use the same principles, you know, just see how it goes. And you know, I had just enough money to kind of get by for a couple months. But yeah, and so I was on there, just couldn't find. I'd found a gig, you say, through Nashville Musicians Fighter. It was a gig at Kimbrough's with a friend of mine, Kellyanne. Same thing, connections last a long time. Mm-hmm. And I made a lot of friends from that group. And so I'd already got a gig like that. But one day, Adam shoots me, he's shooting me text messages of screenshots from the get, literally anything he thought was applicable to me. He took a screenshot of it and sent it to me. And it was like, what do you think about that? And I'd message the people and I'd not either not hear back or I wouldn't hear, you know, I'd be like, oh, sorry, we already got somebody, that kind of thing. And then one day he sends me this listing for need a drummer for a 10 to close on Friday night at Lucky Bastard Saloon. Had no idea what Lucky Bastard Saloon was at the time. I had not really explored Broadway yet. Hadn't had the time. I was just kind of piece by piecing, exploring Broadway.
Right.
You know, and it was, I need someone for Broadway. I need a drummer and here's the set list. And it was like kind of mostly like a rock pop set list. And I was like, sweet, because I did not live here knowing country. Like, I'm sure a lot of people that, you know, right. I think that is the case, a lot of people. And I didn't know most of the country tunes. And so I was like, whoa, this is cool. This is a rock gig. Like, I know these songs, you know, like Mr. Brightside and, you know, Misery Business. And like, oh, I can totally do that, you know.
But probably similar songs to that early band that you found with Craigslist, right?
There were more modern options, like more of the alternative rock stuff. But in terms of the classic rock stuff, all the classic rock stuff, it was like, just, sure. Yeah. Let me know what you want to play.
And plus, you had done the orchestral auditions. You're like, I'm fine.
And it was
I can handle this.
It was a similar thing where it was like, you know, it was that Monday. I remember it was a Monday and I saw the listing and I texted Adam back. I'm like, great, I'll message him on Facebook. And Adam says, no. Here's his phone number. Tell him Adam sent you. And I said, okay. And so I texted Ryan and I said, hey, my friend Adam, really good friend of mine, just put me on to, you know, turn me on to your post. I really think I could be a good fit. I love your set list. I know pretty much all these tunes, and the ones I don't know, I have time to learn this week, and I'll learn them for you. And he's like, I'll send you a little couple videos. I had some Instagram videos I'd made of myself playing and singing and stuff, just to show the singing side too. And he was like, yeah, you sound great. And he's like, so you know, you're pretty comfortable with these tunes. I'm like, yeah, totally. And the ones I don't know, like I said, I don't know. I'll learn them this week. He's like, all right, see you Friday. Yeah. And I was like, excuse me? Yeah, like just at the gig. He's like, yeah, see you at the gig. And
yeah, I
was
love that.
Yeah. All right, and that was my first experience with, you know, see you at the gig.
And that's like, here in Nashville. That's the power of a referral, you know?
Yeah.
It really I've gotten was, so many gigs like that. Yeah. Just, again, the power of relationships, the value of relationships.
Yeah. And
you know, you're not flying solo, but like, what would have happened if it was just you, you know, DMing all these people versus like, hey, I can vouch for this guy, you know, he's a good buddy, he can play.
The times when it's the hardest are when I don't have the time to socialize and do that. Mm-hmm. Those are the hardest times, you know, that make you feel the least productive. It's not even when you're playing the most. It's the time when you're like, I feel like I'm not connecting with people.
Yeah.
You know, that's the hardest thing. But and I played the gig. It was my first time playing on Broadway. It was a Friday 10 to close.
Wow.
Summer of 2021. And so it was like, whoa.
Let's go.
Yeah. Nice. It was so much fun. Like, I mean, it was like the adrenaline hit 20 minutes in. I'm like, this is awesome.
Like, damn, this is how much I can make.
And then that was the other thing too.
And not every night or not every day.
We made a significant amount of money that night. But, and I was like, you're kidding me. I was expecting to make $1,500 and we're coming away with
that was base.
You know, $350. And it was like, were you serious? Like, interesting. And so that's when I was like, I'm going to just play this place hard. You know, I'm going to go come down here as much as I can. You know, whatever gig we get offered, I'm there, you know? And I also took the gig teaching at Brentwood High School. And between those two things, I mean, it was in a month. It was like, you know, had steady enough work to pay the bills. But it was also like, I'm, you know, a lot of people, because you guys have lived here, I imagine, through 2020. You both were here.
Yeah, that's when I moved here, 2020.
Yeah. And so, of course, me coming in after everything's done, you guys dealt with really all the issues, and then I come in after all the issues are dealt with, you know, just, you know, cleaning up, you guys did all the hard work, you know, and it's like, you know, and then we come in here, you know, reaping the benefits of you guys having kept the place alive. But it was, it's crazy because when it came in, it definitely seemed like, you know, there was that period of time when a lot of people had moved away. There were gaps to be filled, you know, bands had stopped playing or they weren't ready to play or they had to get out of their situation so they could play because they'd taken on another situation during COVID, you know. And it was wild because, I mean, everyone had told me back before I moved, of how just crazy it is to get a gig. It's just, you can't walk in and, you know, and we didn't walk in and get a gig,
right.
You know, we were definitely not perfect. You know, we had to work really hard to get to where we are now, you know, and we spent 8 months playing Monday night, 10 to close, Wednesday morning, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., Friday and Saturday, 6 to 10 on the second floor, you know,
yeah.
To, you know, now we're playing Wednesday through Saturday, you know, 6, 10, 10 to close on the main yeah. floor, you know, mm-hmm. and it's like, but that took us a year to get there.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to, sure, you yeah. definitely have to eat some shit.
Definitely, everybody has to.
Earn your stripes, yeah.
But if you prove your worth, you'll get put in at least a decent slot, mm-hmm. and you can make some very, very solid money.
It gives you opportunities. That's a big thing, too, is like, you know, I feel like, you know, expectations plays a big part, you know, and like realistic expectations play such a big part in like my life, too. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it plays to everyone's. You know, when you have realistic expectations about a situation, 99% that situation works out just fine.
Yeah.
It's when you have unrealistic expectations.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, so for me, it was like, I had the realistic expectation of, I'm going to come here and it is going to be saturated.
Yeah.
It's going to be impossible to get a gig for 3 months. I need to have enough money to survive for 3 months without working.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Or I have to take another job to be able to do this. And, you know, once you set those real expectations, sometimes that's not how it is in a good way. It's like, oh no, I found a group that needed work and they're working pretty somewhat consistently.
Yeah.
So Ryan and I met up that way, and we had a singer named Allie at the time, Allie Keck, who we've played solo shows with as well. And, bass player Eric Torres. But then Shannon, our singer, similar thing, like she moved to town, I think, 3 weeks after I did, like right about the same time. She had gone to Berkeley for college and then lived in South Carolina for a year with her mom. And then her and her boyfriend moved at kind of the same time to Nashville. And she was doing a similar thing. She was looking for gigs. And two of her friends from Boston offered her a sub slot to co-front with somebody at Lucky Bastard. I happened to get referred by one of those people to the gig as well. And so I'm playing this gig and there's this female co-front, and like, we both find out we're new to town. And I was just like, man, our band kind of needs like a somewhat regular singer. And I feel like, you know, a lot of our tunes, and a lot of people don't necessarily know all those tunes, like, and are willing to sing them, or, you know, the rock stuff, you know, I mean, it's hard, you know, it's really hard on a female vocalist to sing all that rock stuff. You know, from that gig, I realized Shannon goes hard in the paint, man. Like,
yeah.
I mean, it is like super hard in the paint. And it's like, man, that'd be so cool to be able to just like, boom, here's our vocalist, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, and she was like, I don't know. Like, I mean, I don't know if I necessarily know all your songs. Like, I would hate to ruin the gig. And that was the vibe. I would hate to ruin your gig. And I was just like, you're too nice, man. You know, I was sitting there and just like, just say yes, man. Just come play the gig. You're going to be fine. You know, and they're just saying, I'm like, I'm sure you'll be just fine. And so finally, you know, and she's like, hey, okay, I'll come play a gig. And then we subbed in some others together. And she's like, I'm quitting my day job. I'm doing this full time. I want to just do this, whatever it takes. And so we all kind of did the same thing at the same time, you know? And one of the first gigs that Ryan, Shannon, and I played together was on that Lucky Bastard stage. And we point to the moment that you know, there's always a moment, you know. And the moment we knew was he's walking back to get to the window. You're walking from the right side of Lucky Bastard stage to the window. You have to walk behind the singer. And she's singing, I Love Rock and Roll. And she swung her arm at the wrong time, caught him straight in the nuts. And he is on the ground in pain, doubled over with his guitar, didn't miss a note.
Wow.
And he's used to just, you know, face contorted, and you just didn't stop. And she's looking, just like, are you okay? And he's like, just sing.
And just sing and don't look at me.
You just know sometimes. It's like, okay, this is gonna work.
That's
out.
That's how you fine. Build band chemistry. That's it's recommended, right?
Sometimes it's just a right cross square to the sensitive spots. You know,
like, oh my Lord.
But yeah, and it's like. So it was in pieces, you know. It wasn't necessarily like the band was formed.
And you guys from there just gelled and continued. Like,
yeah,
did you guys all have the same kind of path? And like, you want to sit together, and you all had the same vision to be a full time band. And you know,
we all had that kind of just like, we have worked service jobs, we've worked, you know, day jobs of some sort to pay the bills. We've worked multiple jobs to pay the bills. In my case, where I was just doing I was doing music, but it was like 50 different things, and I felt like I couldn't really get that good at any of them. Because I was doing so many, you know, and it was that kind of, you know, jack of all trades, master of none. And it was just like, man, I need to be able to do something that I'm like the captain with, you know, or like one of the captains.
This is my thing.
You know, and with Nashville, obviously, you know, there's a lot of singer-songwriters and you're a member of their band, right? You're a member of the backing band. You're part of the team and the company, but it's a singer and you're part of the band. And we decided, you know, it was going to be like, okay, it's Shannon's band. And we decided, you know, let's be all equal in this. You know, we all make the same money, and we've formed an LLC recently. We're officially a business.
Nice.
Which is cool. Feels a fit. We got a credit card and a bit, you know, all this stuff. You can pay for stuff for people, and it feels really good to be able to do that for other people too, you know, when we get bassists to come in and play. But we decided we want to be equal members of this, you know, and we all kind of like, there's not enough bands out there. You know, there's a lot of singers, right? There's a lot of singer-songwriters or, you know, artists, right? There's not enough bands. Yeah, I remember growing up when I was a kid, I listened to bands, you know, like Dream Theater and Rush and, you know, Pink Floyd. And like, these guys are bands.
Exactly.
Like, these guys are all co-writing and they're, you know, they're partners. On this. They're all financially invested. They're all committed, you know, and not that there's anything wrong with singer-songwriters. Don't get me wrong. There's so many singer-songwriters here that I love. You know, we just wanted to do something different. You know, we wanted to kind of go that route and fill that gap, which, and inspire kids to form bands, you know.
Yeah, I love that mindset.
That's what made me want to play music.
It's actually, there's a huge value in, and I talked about this in with the Fly Information Boys. I'm like, there's actually a giant, giant value in having disagreements in how the song should go.
Very much so.
When you're like, well, yeah, I really want to add something like this in here. I'm like, he doesn't like that. But Mike, but you love it. You're obsessed with it. And this guy thinks it's cool. Not necessarily obsessed, but thinks it's cool. Yeah. You don't, Mike, we got one, we got a positive, we got a mega positive, and we got one minor negative. We're going with it. Like, because this is, it's a democracy here.
Yeah,
we're like, does this ruin anything? Does it destroy the song? No. Cool. There's mega love from this guy, and you're okay with it. I'm neutral. He kind of doesn't like it, but there's trust. Okay, we're doing it.
Yeah, and to me, like, the democracy situation is always just the best.
Yes.
To me, it really is. You know, at the end of the day, I think that's always the best. Mm-hmm. It's the hardest in a lot of ways. It is incredibly difficult to run a successful democracy in any way, but it's so good when it works.
When it doesn't work is when somebody is consistently the one who's like, well, I really don't like that, and it doesn't go that way. And they're like, well, I'm going to part ways. They're like, but that's natural.
And that's
okay. You're like, okay, well, hey, if you're not liking the stuff that we're liking, we probably shouldn't work together then. That's totally fine. Yep. That shouldn't hurt anyone's feelings.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah. And I've like, you know, and I grew up an only child, you know, growing up, and you know, didn't have any brothers and sisters, and so it's really interesting being in a situation now where these two are like a brother and a sister to me.
Right.
And in terms of like the democracy of it, it's like that it's weird at times that I've never had a brother and sister. I don't know what it's like to deal with having a sibling. You know, they have siblings, you know, and they've dealt with having siblings and the good and the bad, you know, and I never have. I never had to. And, you know, and for good and bad, you know, I mean, for a lot of ways, my childhood was great. You know, a kid, for some ways, it's like, oh, it'd been fun to have a brother or sister here and there. But but it's like never had to have a brother and sister.
Yeah.
And so it is like, you're only child.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Pound it, dude.
Yeah, not me. I'm a twin and I have a sister.
Yeah. We can tell from like the everything about us. But
selfish.
But it's like, but it's really cool because like,
you didn't deny it.
No, never. No. But it's, but yeah, it's fun because, you know, it's a new challenge of, you know, this is a good thing for me. We're in a business relationship with each other. Yes. But it's like, man, we were friends first.
Yeah.
And I've seen friends of mine in musical situations be in bands with people who are friends first, and it falls apart. And it's like, man, I do not want to go down that road.
No.
And it's like, if it means the band breaks up, so be it. You know, you're my friends. But it's, I'm not saying that's happening, obviously. But it's like, they got to preserve something, you know? And it's like, we reiterate family first to each other all the time, where it's like, yeah, it's a family thing, go do it. We'll figure something out. But it's like, yeah, same thing. I mean, they're family. So it is family first, you know? And it's weird being in a place now where like, that job, this Too Hot for Leather gig, pays the bills on its own, you know, for all of us. And it's weird because, you know, we come to Nashville, they say, take all the gigs you can get. And it's like, I don't have necessarily time because we have to spend so much time writing. We're writing original music now, and we're working with a producer, and we're trying to brand ourselves and, you know, move off of Broadway eventually and be an original act.
Yeah.
And it's like, God, that takes a lot of time.
Oh, yeah.
And money and focus. And it's like, I'm going against everything everyone told me to do, which is to work with every artist you can work with and you know, take all those gigs. And it's like, I don't know if I can, just because this gig is just that good.
Yeah.
And it's that fulfilling. You know?
And I think, like, that advice, and this comes up a lot. It's like, take all the gigs until you find that right gig.
Right.
It sounds like you've kind of gotten lucky. You found that gig pretty early on.
Very early. Way more early than I deserve to, you know?
Just kind of nurturing that and just going all in on that.
So. Absolutely. Yeah. That's Too Hot for Leather in a nutshell.
Yeah, very cool. Well, all the stuff, man, I've seen looks freaking killer. Like all the branding, the marketing, the videos, pictures.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, appreciate it, man. So, thank you. Yeah, man. No, we're doing our best.
It's exciting times.
Got a photo shoot next week.
Hell yeah. Where does that name come from? Is that like a
it started as a
Van
joke.
Halen thing?
It started as a joke. No, it's not. I love that you tried to attribute some form of legitimacy to it.
Oh, yeah.
There is none. It was a joke. One of our bass players who plays with us, John Frisch is his name. I don't know if you guys have run into him or not.
The name
sounds familiar.
He's legit. He's a workhorse, man. Like, yeah. Dude, it's if there's anybody, you know, take every gig and do everything you can, like, he can sing, he can play bass. He was a production manager for an artist recently, like, ridiculous. He's unbelievable. But he played bass with us. He's a friend of Ryan's. He was on stage with us on one of our Wednesday morning gigs. And we were standing, I think it was Whiskey Row, maybe we were playing on like a Tuesday or Wednesday early shift. And on that side of the street, on that part, that block, as you know, the sun is shining straight into the windows.
It sure is.
Yeah, it's shining straight into the windows. And of course, we're all dressed in our, you know, like fatigues for work. And, you know, and so John had come down in his cold weather clothes because it was chilly outside. You walk in from the chilly and then you're on stage and you're baking. And we're standing, we were trying to figure out a name for the band that wasn't just like, hey, we're Shannon, Ryan, and Kevin. And just hadn't come up with something. And I remember him saying, it's like, dude, it's like, I got to take this off, man. It's like too hot for leather up here. And we're just like, why don't we just do that?
That's
you know?
A great
And
it's
just
oh
like, boom,
gosh.
You know, let's not ask questions. That's it. Like, yeah. You know, and at the time, you know, we're definitely like, you know, hadn't thought even of like branding and all. We're just like,
yeah.
That's so funny. Let's do it.
I love it.
You know, and that's kind of where a lot of things start from. We're all kind of kids. We're all children.
Especially band names. It's always like the stupidest story.
The three of us are children. So we always start from like, that's really funny. Let's do it.
Yeah.
You know? In a lot of ways. So
that's awesome, man.
Since we are coming to a close, since I have to go run and play a gig.
Nice. But yes, you do.
I
have to go to Bridgestone for a hockey game.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
Yeah. I told my B-Late. It's all good.
Okay.
Yeah. No, it's all good. Yeah.
What's upcoming for you?
Good question. So my friend Wiley Withers, who's a producer in town, he has his own home studio and does tracking in his room. We've worked with a few artists. He's kind of been kind enough to let me explore that side of things as well, producing and helping to like songwrite and arrange. He is going to be releasing an album. We spent last week 9 to 5 every day in his studio writing out and tracking a few songs. He's got a full 10-track album that'll come out at some point. We're writing original music for Too Hot for Leather. We're working with a producer on our first single, so we're getting that around. Hopefully that'll be out early winter, hopefully. Cross fingers.
Cool.
Yeah. Finally get it out into the world. And then, you know, just the kind of one-off shows. We're always playing Broadway where they're Wednesday 6 to 10, Thursday through Saturday 10 to close, and then just whatever gather gigs to pick up and stuff like that. You know, and a lot of it is that we're just trying to get to the point where we can start marketing ourselves as an opener band.
Yeah.
You know, we want to do that. We're at that point where it's like we have good connections in that realm. Through Ryan and elsewhere, and through all three of us, and where it's like we're that close. We just got to get this music done.
Yeah.
We have to have a product. You have to have a song. We have our band. We play all the cover tunes. We got to have our own music, and we are just like chomping at the bit to get that stuff done. So we are pounding away. We got like 6 or 7 songs total in demoing phase. One is done and getting recorded. We're trying to put out a full album. You know, a full record first.
You know,
we weren't trying to do the EP thing. We want to get a full album out first. So those are the big things. Those are the two big things.
Closing question. Favorite thing about Nashville, least favorite thing about Nashville?
Whoa.
Then you're free.
How do we do the least favorite one first? Yeah, like influencer culture's kind of coming to Nashville a bit. You know, you feel that a little bit. Not, you know, and obviously, you know, social media can be good for so many things, but there's a lot of the kind of just like transparent, I guess useless, I guess is the right way not to throw out such a inflammatory word, but it's like, just feels useless sometimes. There's just like, we really need this here. You know, like, that's not what the city, that's not what it felt like the city.
It's not as authentic.
Here. That's not why we moved here. Yeah. You know, I didn't move here for that. I know a lot of people didn't move here for that. Mm-hmm. They moved here because it's an honest city and we work in the real economy. You know, you do something, you get paid for it. But again, it's the modern world, you know, stuff happens. You know, the modern world is a lot of that. You move into that realm. So I get it, but it's like, there's a ton of that. The best part I would say, it's like kind of a, I was trying to decide between one or two things, but I would say it's like, there's so much Mexican food down Nolensville Pike.
Oh my God.
This just came up last episode.
There's so much Mexican food down. I've not tried all of it yet. There's Bob Burrito obviously is really good. That's not like a Nolensville Pike place, but I love Bob Burrito. Yeah.
That's like a dope non-Mexican Mexican.
Yeah, you got to go. Yeah. You just got to go at some point, right? And I would say there's a, I can't remember the name of the place. It's Desayunos, I think. It's in like an old gas station.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
The one on Nolensville by
that's
Plaza
how you know
Mariachi.
It's going to be good, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's like orange decor, and they do the quesadilla. there, oh, and dude. I went a couple of times with my friends Wiley and Daniel, and I remember getting that the first time, and I was like, that's what it's supposed to be.
Yes. You know? Dude, we were just saying this on the yeah. last one. I'll say it again. Yeah. I was blown away when I moved here, yeah. being from California, yeah. and being attached to Mexico. I'm like, yeah, our Mexican food yeah. is like Lit, destroys yeah. what's out here. And I'm like, everywhere I went, I'm like, this is just terrible. And then we discovered Nolensville Pike. I was like, oh, yeah. they're all out here.
That's
all,
where they are.
It's right here. Awesome.
It's literally
here.
On this one yeah. strip of land.
Yeah, yeah, like for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Cool, man. Well, just quick, give us the plugs for yourself and the band.
Yeah, of course. I'm Kevin Keith.
Oh, God, that's your name.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, just, okay. We'll just copy and paste that throughout the episode. Band's Too Hot for Leather. Our Instagram is also Too Hot for Leather. We're on TikTok, Facebook, Instagram. I'm on Instagram as well. Kevin Keith, musician. I've got some of my own solo music that I'm releasing as well. And then I'm just around. Come say hi.
Cool.
Say hello. You know.
Well, dude, we can't wait to see what comes of your career and the band. And
thank you very much. Yeah,
can't wait to keep talking. A lot of these topics were just like, yeah. I felt bad we had to keep kind of short, but
we'll be watching your career with great interest.
No, it's like, I really can't wait to see you guys out and like,
yeah, man, we'll keep chatting, like, I'm sure, about all this.
Yeah,
so we'll definitely be out and seeing you guys.
Well, that's one of the sickest parts about doing this podcast is I'll encounter some of these people out in the wild, and then we'll have a thing. We'll, do a podcast, mm-hmm. but every time I do that, I'm like, oh, I feel so much more connected to you. Like,
yeah,
now
that barrier is
like, yeah, it's gone.
It's gone.
Yeah, yeah, like I would see Nico around, and I'm like, he's an interesting guy. I want to like to connect with him. And then ever since, I'm like, that's like my buddy.
He could be an intimidating, especially Nico.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure. It's like,
because he's kind of eccentric and interesting and like a beast.
Tall.
And like, it was cool, man. Like, I mean, I saw him playing at Johnny Cash the other night right before we went on, and I was playing a gig there, and I saw him. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure that's Nico. And I was like, oh, I just heard his podcast. I'm gonna go up and tell him that his podcast was great. It gave me a reason to talk to him.
Yeah, I love that.
And
use our podcast to break down your fear of talking to new people.
Exactly. You know, we all got that. You know?
Reason number 37 to listen to Nashville Drummers Podcast, Icebreaker.
Great topic at parties.
Like a freaking fat penguin, you know what I'm saying? Breaking the ice.
Oh, man, that's funny.
All right. Well, dude, thanks for the time.
Thank you, man. Appreciate you guys. She heard their favorite song and she couldn't stand the sound.
Eyes full of tears, she turned that wheel around. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Nashville Drummers Podcast. If you liked it, please consider leaving us a review on the Apple Podcast app.
Also, check out our new website, NashvilleDrummersPodcast.com. And if you're not already following us on Instagram, you can follow us at Nashville Drummers Podcast.
This episode was recorded at Diamond Sound Studios, located in Nashville, Tennessee.
Sponsored by Music Lab Nashville, production by The Wise Company. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.